Tonight's talk is on how stress works and how how stress works is that's the first part of the talk done for us, and how stress works and understanding how we create it in our lives and what we can do to alleviate it. And fortunately, the tools that the Buddha provided are over 2,500 years ago are still not only applicable today, but are increasingly being used in virtually every single stress reduction program there are. So, starting out with, to address the fundamental issue, which is that the default mind, what the Buddha called the uninformed mind, avijja, tends to blame all of our stress on external events. We tend to blame our difficulties at work with our co-workers, our difficulties at home with our loved ones or roommates, our difficulty in the world with why aren't people more polite. And then we have a sense of overall victimization, understandably sometimes that's attributable to the natures of capitalism and other elements of our economic system and whatnot. And to be sure, suffering does arise from external events, but from a spiritual angle, there's virtually nothing you can do about other people. You can't change them other than tossing them entirely out of your lives, which you certainly can. We really can't get rid of the suffering caused by other people. And even if we did, even if we became rich and powerful beyond our wildest dreams and had all the comforts that we could imagine, still, the Buddha said that life was filled with stress. And that's why, even though he was born rich and in very comfortable means, he left it all behind. Because he said, even somebody who's powerful and rich and beautiful with model looks and whatnot, and born into luxury, they too will grow old sick. This they will know death. And not only that, on a daily basis, things like not getting what we want, getting what we don't want, being frustrated, being insulted by others, being separated from what we love, being stuck with people we hate, all these things will happen to us no matter how much power we accrue. They are not going to go away, even if you hit the lucky number in the lottery. You're still going to know suffering. As in fact, many, many tests establish. They've actually given tests of people who win the lottery and also people who have sudden, really bad events in life, like suddenly becoming handicapped and in accidents. And they find that after a few months' period of time, they go back to the exact same amount of baseline happiness they had right before they hit the big ticket. So if your solution is changing the world around you or changing people around you or getting rid of the external conditions, that's not going to work. However, luckily there is a solution. The Buddha taught that the way we create stress is literally the way we attend and experience and perceive and the way we use the mind. So let's talk a little bit about it. Let's say we're starting off our day at work and we show up and we go into the office, if we work in an office. I'm sorry to hear that if that's the case. So you go into that fluorescent lit cubicle hellhole, surrounded by other stressful people worrying about nonsense, and then you look around and you take in the background and you're looking basically for any new information to indicate that something has changed. There's a new opportunity, a good-looking person, to flirt with, or something along those nature, those lines, or perhaps you're looking for a threat, a new boss, supervisor, a new person working next door to your cubicle, whatever. If you don't find anything particularly new, you're not going to continue scanning the background. In fact, most of the times, the backgrounds that we see, right now, if you're looking at me, the background is everything else but me. Most of the time, that background is not constantly flowing into the mind. It's something you look at once and you or twice, and you create a static image. And it remains there until new information tells you otherwise. This is how, they can make movies so small enough that they can be downloaded. They don't redo the frame every time there's a new frame. If the colors don't change in the background, they don't add any new information. They only add new information to a compressed file when the color changes. So now that I've geeked out on you, just think of it in the same way. You're not updating the background unless something really new and important is there. There's a lot of fascinating perceptual tests on how much you can change in backgrounds without people noticing it. You can actually, if you do it subtly enough, put entire chairs and couches and new things in backgrounds that people will not notice until their attention is called to it, because we're not actually seeing the background. We're only checking in to it once in a while. Why do we only check into it once in a while? Because it's really, really tiring. It requires a lot of dopamine to look around and construct an environment. So we only do it as little as possible. When you're physically tense, though, when you're carrying stress, when you're hungry, when you're tired, irritable, when you're anxious, when you've just carried, you've had a real difficult argument with somebody, and you walk into a room, you're actually going to increase the amount of times you scan the background. And this is actually stressful to the mind. If you're hungry, you're going to look around for food. You're going to be called. Your attention to any smell will call your attention. If you're thirsty, you'll look around for water. If you're anxious, you'll look around for frightening information. So the more anxious you are, the more you scan the world. And that actually causes a release of dopamine and adrenaline, which in turn releases stress hormones. And we'll talk about that in a second. So that's one way we can create stress. Simply by carrying around physical tension that makes us more hyper-vigilant or hyper-alert. Now, when something from the background is really threatening or important or something you think needs to be addressed, it comes to your attention and you focus your awareness on it, and that actually uses up dopamine to do that. If it's something that's going to be around for a while and you decide that it's safe, like the ticking of a clock in a new room, you'll do something that's known as habituate. Habituate simply means you'll get used to it and that sensation will no longer be important enough for you to follow it, and you'll relegate it back to the background. You'll no longer dedicate your precious attentive resources to it. If you perceive something as important, but then you see that it's going to go away on its own, that you don't have to do anything about it, you'll also consign it to inattention. For example, you're in an office, and somebody says, here's your new coworker. They'll be with you forever. You will be spending the rest of the day observing them. You will not be able to pay attention to anything else. You'll be looking at every little irritating thing they do. You will hate them soon enough. On the other hand, let's look at that scenario where here's the person working in the cubicle next to you. They'll be gone by tomorrow. Your mind will take one look at them, get a sense of who they are, and you'll go right back to your Facebook typing in messages about Tuesdays. Anyway, You get it. So if we perceive something as lasting and threatening, we'll keep attending to it. But if we perceive something as safe or impermanent, we'll let it go. Now, suppose there's something we have to do. The best, most efficient way we can do things in life is called flow. Flow is a neuroscience term, although it doesn't sound like one. Flow sounds like something a hippie would say to you. Want to hear a bad hippie joke?
Yeah.
This is a non-Buddhist, horrible hippie joke. What? Don't take this personally. This is bad. What's the difference between a hippie and an onion?
And
an onion.
No.
No one cries when they cut an onion. Okay. Hey, it's Dharma Punks. Dharma Punks. And this is, by the way, do not act out on it. We each get a break from the Buddhism for a moment. And then we go back. Yeah, what?
No one cries when they cut a hippie.
What did I say?
No one cries when they cut an onion.
Oh, when they cry a hippie. Oh, shit. Jesus, I ruined the joke. Oh, my God. Wow. I felt bad about telling that joke, and then that's what happens. You sabotage yourself. All right. All right. So anyway, flow sounds like something a hippie might say, but it's actually a neuroscience term, and it means basically that state that we go into when we're effortlessly absorbed, we love what we're doing, something that we've practiced doing a lot of times. Something we can fall into. If you play the piano, if you ride your bike, if you hike in the mountains, if you paint, if you write, whatever it is that you fall into, and you lose track of time, and you lose track of what other people were saying and background events, that is known as flow. Why is it that you lose track of time and background events? Well, the reason flow is so efficient is because it uses different lobes of the brain that are normally used to establish what time it is, what's going on around us, what's going on in the background. When we're in flow, those lobes, such as the parietal and parts of the temporal lobe, stop doing those tasks. They think, oh, I'm safe. I've done this a million times before. I don't have to keep track of time. I don't have to keep track of what other people are saying to me. I can actually just focus on what I love doing. And when we're in flow, we're actually working about 200% faster. Even though we enjoy what we're doing, we're working twice as fast as when we're not in flow. It's the most revered of all the states of the mind because it uses up the least neurotransmitters. It doesn't tire you out. You can be in flow for 12 hours and still feel energized afterwards because you're not using up too much dopamine to sustain it. You're not going to trigger unnecessary thoughts that cause the fight or flight mechanism. You won't be thinking, oh shit, what do I look like? What are other people thinking about me? What's going to happen to me in the future? You won't be thinking those thoughts that create so much stress. Now, the next kind of attention that you have that you use a lot of, though you don't particularly know what it's called, the term is executive function. That's when you're not in flow, when you're using your thoughts. Right now, you are all, hopefully, those of you who are not fast asleep or regretting being here are probably in a state of executive function, meaning you are focusing and thinking or taking in what I'm talking about. But because what I'm talking about is new to you, you have to sustain your attention. If it was flow, you'd have done it a million times. You would have heard me giving talks a million times and you wouldn't have to pay attention. But when you're an executive, you have to pay attention. And that requires you using up dopamine. There's nothing too bad about that. There's only two problems. A, when you use up dopamine, you get exhausted at the end of the day. This is why chess masters or people who use their minds or go to a lot of meetings or have a lot of focus and thinking outside of the box kind of creativity, at the end of the day, can use up a lot of energy. Not only the dopamine, but there actually was a study that showed that a grandmaster playing chess tournament over the course of 6 hours uses up the same amount of calories as a marathon runner, just by thinking. So, that is, yes. So, that is why thinking is not as completely neutral an activity as you thought it was. Now, again, there's nothing too wrong with executive function. So long as you know to take a break and relieve the usage of dopamine and take a walk around, you probably will get through a day of a lot of meetings or a lot of creative focus without too much unnecessary stress or suffering, because you're focusing your mind on a task. However, if you're not in executive focus, you are in what's known as default mode. Default mode sounds like it should be wonderful. It sounds like there should be a couch in the mind with a TV set and somebody rubbing our feet. That's what default should be. I should be happy in default mode. Guess what? Default mode, though it sounds really nice, is actually one of the most stressful states of mind there is. Why? Well, Harvard comes to our rescue here. Those clever rich kids up there did a test where they called up people throughout the day and had them also check in electronically, and they found that when people were engaged in tasks, whether in flow or executive function, they were actually not stressed out. But when people were sitting in front of their computer with nothing to do for hours on end, guess where their minds went? They went straight to the most stressful thoughts any human mind can go to. Me and what's going to happen to me, i.e. the unknowable. Put those two magic ingredients together, thinking about yourself and sheer speculation, and you've got the perfect ingredients for a pastry known as suffering. It is the Miracle-Gro of misery. What's going to happen to me? What do other people think about me? How do I compare about with other people? These are the three thoughts guaranteed to bring you into the blues. So that's where we often tend to head in default network. It's also known as task independent, because we don't have a fucking task to do. And when we don't, we wind up going wherever the mind drifts to, and it drifts to what it thinks will make us safe, figuring out what's going to happen to us in the future. In fact, it doesn't make us safe, it makes us miserable. So let's summarize. Two of the three ways that so far cause us stress are A, checking the background too much or unnecessarily, and B, allowing our minds to go to inessential thoughts about ourselves and speculation. These are known as task inessential ideation to clinical therapists. It simply means allowing your mind to go wherever it wants to trigger thoughts that put you in a state of stress. The final way you cause stress unnecessarily in your life, I should have added also attending to things, believing that they're permanent or dangerous. But the other way you create stress is what people commonly know as multitasking. Every single time you move your mind from one object to another object, you completely, in that instance, when you drop one focus and you move to another narrative, and you pay attention to someone else and what they're saying, you need to use both adrenaline and cortisol to accomplish that task. Now, adrenaline isn't that bad. In fact, adrenaline, despite its bad rep, it actually feels pretty good. A hit of adrenaline is like a cup of coffee. It makes you feel awake and alert. It's an alertness neurotransmitter. The problem is that with adrenaline, there's another sneaky partner that arises in your mind. That sneaky partner is cortisol. Cortisol is the hormone that prepares you for a fight, because every time you change your attention or you perceive something threatening or important, via evolution, we've been primed to become alert and in a state of awareness and preparation and readiness to move. So every time you become completely refocused on something, you're not just releasing adrenaline, which will quickly break down in the brain, but you're releasing cortisol, which the thoughts will continue going. Now, why should you give a fuck about something called cortisol? It sounds like cortisone, which is a cream. It sounds like it should be fine. It sounds like it should be an ingredient in fighting diaper rash. In fact, what cortisol is the stress hormone. What are the things it does? It causes high blood pressure. It stops you from producing white blood cells. It starts you creating unnecessary red blood cells. While you're releasing cortisol, you do not digest food. You stop digesting. Why? Because your body now thinks you're about to be attacked by a tiger, or that you're going to have to run from a wild boar. That's what evolution has put into you. It does not know that you're simply looking at somebody's shoes that you like. Cortisol also causes premature aging because it attacks cells. It causes numerous stress-related problems like strokes and heart attacks and arteriosclerosis. And if you didn't think that was a fun enough list as in and of itself, guess what? It causes Alzheimer's disease. Why? Because cortisol directly attacks the hippocampus, which is what creates short-term memory and what is the attacked when we have Alzheimer's disease, our short-term working memory. So any job where we're constantly distracted, diverted, where we're constantly triggered, where we constantly think that something's important, where we're constantly stopping to answer questions, is going to be far more stressful than a job where we can focus and sustain our attention. In fact, studies have shown that somebody who's got 9 tasks to do in a day and somebody who's got the exact same task but only 3, if the person who does the 9 does them 1 at a time, focusing on each, while limiting their distractions, will not only get the 9 jobs done in the same time as the person who's only doing 3, but they'll actually experience far less stress and suffering. The person who does 3 but jumps around, answers questions, becomes distracted, checks every email that comes in, every single question that's asked, in fact, will wind up with far more stress, release cortisol in their blood systems when they take these, when they take the saliva swabs in these tests. It's interesting that when they do baseline happiness scans, people in buildings, they find that they expected, I should say, that the company owners would be the happiest person in the building, followed by down the financial chain. In fact, they found that in every building they tested, the happiest people were the janitors. The janitors focused, got into states of flow, didn't allow themselves to be distracted, didn't answer questions when it was asked of them. They were by far and away the happiest people in every building. And in fact, the people who were the most miserable were not the new employees who didn't have a, you know, a were being too caught up in meetings. They were actually upper middle management. The people who had a lot of responsibilities, who felt that they constantly had to stop and make new decisions and were constantly having their attention pulled in different directions. So, again, the ways we cause stress are needlessly attending to stimuli, believing that it's permanent, constantly checking the background, being in a state of default, non-task, drifting of minds, daydreaming as it were, and finally multitasking or scattered jumpy attention. So all of the Buddhist tools that I introduce when we meditate at the beginning are set up specifically to counteract this phenomenon. The reason why I start out with a 20-minute meditation, the first 20 minutes being devoted to concentration, is because it takes you 20 minutes to get, on average, into flow. If you can establish concentration in meditation, in, you know, your practice, you're increasing the likelihood that in other endeavors you can quickly get into a state of flow. The second part of the meditation, also besides that, when you're in concentration, you learn how to put aside inessential thoughts that might you would might normally attach to that would cause suffering and stress in your life. For example, how am I doing so far? How much fucking longer before he rings the bell? These are the same thoughts that cause suffering in your life. Just transfer them into a workplace. How much longer do I have to be here? What do other people think about me? If you can use your meditation to learn how to put these inessential thoughts aside, there will be far less elements, stimuli, pulling you out of flow, which is the most relaxed state your mind can be in. The second part of our meditation, the last 5 to 10 minutes, is what we call Vipassana. That's when I say allow the breath to subside a little and greet whatever passes through your mind, but don't allow it to pull you away from the present moment. Keep your awareness also knowing when you're breathing in or out or what the body's doing. Now, why is this helpful? Because when you're in a state of flow or executive concentration, if you can note when somebody wants your attention, simply say, I'll get back to you when I'm finished with this, and still keep in mind enough of what you're doing in your forefield attention, you don't break flow. So you can stay in your optimum state. You're using the least amount of adrenaline and cortisol. If, however, every single time a new sensation comes up to us and we drop away and we go to it and we drop what we're doing entirely, we completely lose flow, and it takes about 20 to 25 minutes to get back into it. You may think it's faster, but it's not. Every single test establishes that it takes a long time if you've completely dropped the narrative of what you're doing. So you don't want to, every single time somebody says something or there's a stimuli or somebody asks you if you want to have lunch, if you drop everything, then you're making it far harder for you to concentrate and establish ease in what you're doing. In one study in Southern California, there's this woman who calls herself an attention specialist. I want that job. But she basically has documented that people believe they have to multitask far, far, far more than their jobs actually require. She studied people who were taught beforehand to focus and those who were allowed to do their job whichever way they naturally default did. And they found that people think Because we're brought up in an attention-rich, demanding information environment where we're constantly bombarded with Facebook feeds and incoming text messages and incoming emails. We come to believe that it's our duty to observe and analyze and evaluate each new message as it arrives. And guess what? That's not true. Virtually every single job she analyzed, even people who worked with customers in retail environments, she found that if they knew how to structure their jobs correctly, they could get through the day with periods where they could establish flow. It's simply because we don't know how to manage our time, and we think it's our duty to drop everything and attend to things that are not essential in that moment. Another thing that Buddhism helps us with is understanding that all things are impermanent. The more you meditate, the more you understand that a lot of the things that we devote our attention to and create stress over will pass on their own. This is what's known as anicca, and it's one of the inevitable recognitions that arises over a long-term meditation practice and what we talk about all the time. The more you experience life as just sensations arising and passing, the less you need to get involved, the less stressful you'll find your work in your life. And also, we also teach what's known as nothing is personal, anatta. And what this means is that all of our experiences are transpersonal. All of the emotions we experience, the fear, the rejections, the breakups, the abandonments, the setbacks, they happen in every life. The details might be different, but emotionally, we all experience setbacks. And the way we cause suffering is when we go through a disappointment or a frustration and we take it personally, or we try to figure out why it's happening. Then we devote all the mind's resources to stress, to inessential cognition. It's inessential because there'll never be an answer. In life, there is setbacks, sufferings, frustrations. There's nothing we can do about it. And trying to figure out why me doesn't bring about peace or security. It brings about more stress and suffering. Now, there are a couple of things to bear in mind outside of Buddhist practice that will help you reduce the amount of unnecessary suffering. I'm just going to go over them very quickly. Number one, if you can, rather than structure your day so that you have meetings or interpersonal contact throughout the course of the day, it's actually far, far more efficient if you leave a bulk of time set aside for tasks that you love doing, that you can get into a state of easeful flow. Times where you don't allow your attention to be broken. People tend to undervalue their unused blocks of time. And when somebody says, hey, what's up at around 3? You want to have a meeting? And we look, and between 2 and 4 we have a nice block. We almost invariably say, sure, I got nothing going on. Ain't nothing happening then. What we've just done is given up potentially the most valuable hours of work where we can set our attentions undivided to getting our projects done in an easeful, creative, non-fatiguing way. Oh, yes. Only worry about things that are absolutely necessary for you to keep in mind. One study I read, they were asking what people thought about, and they found that during the course of the average day, people at work tend to spend a lot of time, more time than they actually think of their own responsibilities, wondering about how other people attend to their jobs. This is madness. Not only can you not control whether somebody else will be able to do their job in time the way you like. You'll never know. You'll never be able to predict it. And even if you can, predicting, oh, they're going to fuck it up, that doesn't bring you any state of ease. You're still going to have to deal with the fuck up later on. So living in it beforehand, and then when they deliver the fuck up, is just creating twice as much fuck ups in your mind. After top-down cognition, when we're in meetings where we're really paying attention, it's really useful to do a different kind of flow, which is basically walk around, take a break, go outside, do something in an environment that's not too busy that you don't have to monitor. This brings me up to my most important practice outside of having a daily meditation practice and monitoring your physical stress during the day so that you can relax the body and thus not overcheck the background. Finally, it's worthwhile having a ritual at the end of each workday that establishes for yourself that time to think about your job is officially over. Why is this? They've found that people who don't know how to break cognition, that don't know how to put down the dramas of the day, keep on releasing dopamine. And when you release dopamine, you overemphasize the importance of what's going on in your job, and you disable your ability to prioritize and view things in perspective. Being able to put your job down in the hours after you leave, it may sound hard, it may sound human to ruminate and think about it, but what you're doing is destroying your ability to understand how really important it is in the long run. One of the monks that I studied with said, at the end of your day, don't think about your job. Remind yourself that you're going to die. And this was one of the best advice I've ever gotten. Because immediately, all that shit lost all its importance immediately. The insulting aside, the project behind schedule, the disappointing remark or the lack of recognition for hard work done, all of it stopped mattering when I realized that I've only got a few years on this planet, and will any of this shit really matter when I'm really counting my days? No. I'm not sure that each of you will sit reflecting on death after work, so what I would recommend instead is find a park or a body of water. Why? Well, these are backgrounds that you won't feel the need to monitor that much. These are backgrounds that you'll be able to relax with. Put down any thought about what's happened to the day and just take in all the sensations that are occurring around you. The contact with what you're sitting on, the breeze, the sounds, the feeling of anything on your skin, all the body sensations, and sit there until you can fully make contact with the present. And have this be your ritual that puts aside the day. Do not go rushing home after work. If you do that, you make it far less likely that you'll be able to put down the dramas, and then you'll make it impossible for you to establish good priorities in your life. In order to have a right frame of mind in our work, we have to know really how important it is. People who overemphasize the importance of their work suck at what they do because they get stressed out, they become miserable. They become blown about by bad news, they become reactive, and they wind up making everybody else around them miserable as well. So that's today's talk. I'm sorry I went over long, but I had a lot of information to impart. Once again, if you can, if you're leaving at this point before the questions, if you can give money to support the teachings and the meetings, because it's really essential. We financially make all the responsibilities that we have here. I thank you. And now I'd like to answer some questions from people who found the talk to be...
The talk to...